You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity.
Welcome. Today we're diving deep, really deep, into cardiac output. It's one of those things, right? CO. Just two letters, often a single number on the monitor.
But it's so much more than that. It's really the essence, you could say, the integrator of our entire cardiorespiratory function.
Absolutely. And when that number dips or starts trending the wrong way, well, you realize pretty quickly you're not just managing arithmetic.
No, you're managing this incredibly complex dynamic interplay. It's physics, it's cell physiology, pharmacology, all playing out in real time, and sometimes it falters.
Exactly. So our mission today in this deep dive is to get beyond just that textbook definition.
Right. We want to look at CO from the molecules, like the calcium channels in the heart muscle.
All the way up to the monitors we use, the waveforms, the dynamic indices that guide our decisions minute by minute in the OR.
The goal is for you, the listener, to really be able to interpret flow and function, not just, you know, read off a number.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. Nail down that core definition first. Cardiac output. It's simply the total amount of blood the heart pumps out into the body per minute.
And it comes from that fundamental equation, the one everyone learns early on. Cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. CO equals SVXHR.
Yeah, seems straightforward enough.
Deceptively simple, though. Because what's normal for a resting adult, sure, we might say 4 to 8 liters per minute, something like that.
But size matters a lot, which is why we use the cardiac index, right, to normalize it.
Exactly. CO divided by body surface area, that gives us a much tighter range, usually around 2.5 or 4.0 liters per minute per square meter.
And that indexing is just crucial because, you know, 5 liters per minute might be perfectly fine for your, say, 50 kilo patient who's cool and sedated under GA, low metabolic demand.
But take that same 5 liters per minute in a 150 kilo patient with a raging fever, septic.
It's disaster territory, complete inadequacy.
So the absolute number, it's only part of the story. It's the trend. And more importantly, what that trend means physiologically for that specific patient relative to their oxygen needs.
Which brings us right to the crux of it. Why we care so deeply about CO.
Yeah. Part one. Why does COU matter? It's all about oxygen delivery. DOU.
Precisely. That's the end game. DOU. It's the total amount of oxygen delivered to the tissues each minute. And the formula is simple, too. DOU equals cardiac output times the arterial oxygen content, the CO.
DOU is COXCOU.
And we can often make that COU look great, can't we? Give 100% oxygen, crank up the FeO, saturation hits 100%, looks fantastic on paper.
But if the pump, the CO, is sluggish, if the flow is low,
then the oxygen isn't getting where it needs to go. The tissues are suffocating, even with a perfect CO.
And that leads us to this really dangerous concept, this silent enemy in the OR, cryptic hypoperfusion.
That's a great term for it, cryptic, because everything might look okay on the surface. Sats are 100. Maybe the blood pressure isn't even that low initially.
But the flow state is just inadequate. The delivery truck, loaded with oxygen, has basically stalled on the highway.
And the challenge for us, clinically, is telling the difference between, you know, simple, maybe benign hypotension after induction that'll resolve easily.
Right. A little fluid, maybe a touch of pressor.
Versus true, dangerous cryptic hypoperfusion, where the cells, the mitochondria, are already starting to panic. They're running out of oxygen, switching over to anaerobic metabolism.
So if that's happening, if the tissues are starved for flow, despite maybe okay-ish numbers, what are the subtle signs? What are those whispers of distress we need to tune into beyond just the blood pressure cuff?
Well, the earliest, most direct metabolic signal is a rising lactate. That's the biochemical footprint of anaerobic metabolism kicking in. Cellular distress.
Okay, so checking a lactate, especially things seem off, is key. What about clinically? At the bedside.
You look at the periphery? Are the hands and feet getting cold? Is the capillary refill getting sluggish, you know, more than 2-3 seconds? Any mottling of the skin?
Even subtle changes, maybe altered mentation if the patient's awake enough, or a drop in urine output if the hypoperfusion is severe or prolonged?
These are all signs that flow isn't matching demand.
So stepping back, our job as anesthesiologists, it's really this constant balancing act, isn't it?
Absolutely. We're deliberately applying physiological insults, our drugs, our ventilation strategies.
And we have to constantly gauge how the patient's system is coping, specifically their ability to maintain that oxygen delivery, that DOU.
Our whole mission, really, is keeping DOERs above the body's metabolic needs, the VOERs, if delivery drops below consumption.
Even for a short while, you're heading straight towards organ dysfunction. Regional ischemia first, then potentially systemic problems, longer recovery, complications.
Maintaining that optimal flow is everything.
Yeah.
Which means we absolutely have to understand what determines it. What are the components of COO?
Okay, let's get into part two then, the determinants. I really like the four-legged table analogy for this. It makes it intuitive.
Yeah, it works well. Cardiac output stands on four legs: preload, afterload, contractility, and heart rate.
And they're all interdependent. If one leg gets weak or suddenly changes length,
the whole table tilts, the system becomes unstable, and flow, the CO, inevitably suffers.
And critically, if you try to fix a wobbly table without figuring out which leg is the problem,
you're just chasing symptoms. Mm. You're not addressing the root cause. You might even make it worse.
Right. So let's break them down. Leg number one, preload, the filling factor. How should we really visualize this?
Okay, think of the ventricle as a pump, maybe like a balloon pump. But it's a special balloon that actually works better the more you stretch it before you squeeze it. Up to a certain point, of course.
So preload is that stretch. It's the volume of blood filling the ventricle right at the end of diastole, just before contraction starts.
Mechanically, we define it as the end diastolic volume, the EDV. Or sometimes we measure the pressure associated with that volume, the end diastolic pressure, EDP.
And clinically, we often use surrogates, right? Like central venous pressure, CVP, for the right heart, or pulmonary artery occlusion pressure, PAOP, the wedge pressure, to estimate left heart filling pressure, the LVEDP.
Exactly. Though we know those static pressures have limitations. But the concept is about the filling, or the stretch.
And this stretch is what activates that beautiful intrinsic mechanism, the Frank Starling law. It's not just simple mechanics, is it?
Not at all. It's incredibly elegant. When you increase the filling volume, you stretch the muscle fibers, the sarcomeres.
That stretch physically aligns the actin and myosin filaments better, puts them in a more optimal position for overlap.
Right, but the real molecular magic is that the stretch also increases the sensitivity of troponin C to calcium.
Ah, okay, so for the same amount of calcium released inside the cell,
a slightly more stretched sarcomere will bind that calcium more effectively and generate a stronger contraction on the very next beat. It's the heart's built-in way of matching output to input, volume translating directly into force. Nature's auto-tuning.
Brilliant. But here's the kicker for us in anesthesia. We routinely mess this system up, that classic post-induction hypotension. It's usually not the pump failing initially, is it?
Rarely. 9 times out of 10, maybe more, it's a failure of filling. It's venous collapse.
Talk about that. Why do our drugs do this?
Most of our go-to induction agents, propofol, definitely the volatile gases like Savo, Desflane, they are potent venodilators. They relax the smooth muscle on the walls of the large veins, the capacitance vessels.
So the venous system suddenly gets baggy.
Exactly. Blood just pools out there away from the central circulation. Venous return to the heart plummets, and a venous return drops, preload drops. Simple as that.
It's like the reservoir is fine, but the pipes feeding into it suddenly lose all their tone and pressure. Then add insult to injury, maybe we do a spinal or epidural.
And boom, you layer on a chemical sympathectomy. Even more profound venous pooling. Preload takes another massive hit.
And we haven't even mentioned the ventilator yet.
Yeah, right. Once we take over breathing with positive pressure ventilation, we're constantly pushing pressure into the chest. That increased intrathoracic pressure squeezes the great veins and the right atrium.
Physically impeding the blood flow, trying to get back into the heart.
Correct. So you've got pharmacological venodilation and mechanical impedance to venous return. It's a double whammy against preload. The Starling curve effectively gets shifted down and to the left.
Okay, so the curve itself might be slightly depressed by the anesthetic agents affecting calcium, and we've slid way down the curve because the filling volume dropped off a cliff. How do we manage that? Just pour in fluids.
Carefully. We need precision here. Because it's usually a mix of volume maldistribution and maybe some mild depression. Yes, small measured fluid boluses often help. You need to get some volume back into that central circulation.
But fluids alone won't fix the floppy pipes.
Exactly. You typically need to combine that fluid challenge with a little bit of a vasopressor or something with venoconstrictor effects, like phenylephrine or norepinephrine, to restore some of that venous tone.
So fluid and squeeze, basically.
Often, yes. The big trap is just blindly flooding the patient with liters of crystalloid, especially if they weren't actually volume down to begin with. Pushing them way over to the flat part of the Starling curve is inefficient, increases wall stress, and risks pulmonary edema.
Good point. We should definitely mention the exception here among induction agents. Ketamine.
Ah, ketamine. Unique beast. In vitro, on isolated heart muscle, it's actually a mild depressant.
But that's not what we see clinically, usually.
No. Because in vivo, its dominant effect is stimulating the sympathetic nervous system. It causes a release of endogenous norepinephrine and inhibits its reuptake.
So it gets the patient their own internal squeeze.
Pretty much. It acts like an immediate venous constrictor and cardiac stimulant. It helps maintain venous return, preserves preload, supports heart rate and contractility. That's why it's so valuable for induction in those really fragile, hypovolemic, or hemodynamically unstable patients. It props up the system instead of knocking it down.
Makes sense. Okay, that's preload covered. Let's move to leg number two of our table, afterload.
Right, afterload. Yeah. If preload is the fill, afterload is the resistance the ventricle faces when it tries to eject that blood. It's the impedance to outflow.
The burden the pump has to push against.
Exactly. Clinically, the main component we think about is the systemic vascular resistance, the SVR. It's the collective resistance of all those downstream blood vessels, mainly the arterioles.
So it's the pump versus the hose network.
That's a good way to put it. And understanding resistance brings us back to physics. Specifically, Poiseuille's law. This is just critical for hemodynamics.
Remind us of the key part.
The key takeaway is that flow is proportional to the radius of the vessel raised to the fourth power. Flow radius, O.
The fourth power! That's huge!
It's immense. Think about what that means. If you constrict an arterial's radius by just 10%.
Okay, a tiny change.
You increase the resistance so much that the flow through it drops by almost half. Roughly a 40% reduction, it's exponential.
Wow. That explains how the body can make such rapid and dramatic changes in blood pressure and flow distribution just by tweaking the tone of those tiny little arterioles.
And why are vasoactive drugs are so potent? Tiny changes in receptor activation lead to massive functional changes because of that fourth power relationship.
On a cellular level, in that vascular smooth muscle, what's controlling that tone, that constriction and relaxation?
It's a balance. Contraction is primarily driven by intracellular calcium levels, activating myosin light chain kinase, or MLCK. That leads to phosphorylation and cross-bridge cycling muscle contracts.
And relaxation.
Relaxation pathways are often triggered by things like nitric oxide.
NO.
NO activates guanylate cyclase, makes cyclic GMP, cGMP, which ultimately leads to dephosphorylation of those myosin light chains, and the muscle relaxes, vasodilation.
Okay, and here's where our anesthetics come in again, particularly the volatile gases.
Precisely. Sevoflurane, desflurane.
Yeah.
They tap into these relaxation pathways. They might enhance NO sensitivity or directly affect calcium channels or potassium channels in the smooth muscle. The net effect is vasodilation. They lower the SVR.
So even if the heart itself is pumping just fine, strong contractility, good preload, if the SVR plummets because the patient is deep on volatile anesthetic,
blood pressure will drop. Hypotension results from the loss of resistance, not necessarily from a failure of flow initially.
And this brings us to a crucial clinical decision point. Patient's hypotensive. Is it low flow, low CO, or is it low resistance, low SVR?
You have to figure that out because the treatment is completely different.
Right. If it's low resistance, say the patient feels warm, maybe the pulse pressure is wide, you suspect vasodilation from the anesthetic or maybe sepsis, pouring in more fluid isn't the primary answer?
No, that's the filling a sieve problem. You're not addressing the underlying issue, which is the excessively dilated vasculature. You'll just end up volume overloading them, especially if their heart function is borderline.
So in that scenario, low SVR.
You need a pressing agent, a vasopressor, something like norepinephrine or phenylephrine to restore that vascular tone, bring the resistance back up, and support the blood pressure.
It all comes down to identifying which leg of the table is wobbly. Is it preload, filling, or afterload resistance?
Or is it the pump itself? Which brings us to the third leg.
Leg number three, contractility, also known as anatropy.
Yep. This is the heart muscle's intrinsic strength of contraction. Its inherent pumping power, independent of how much it was filled, preload, or how hard it has to push, afterload. It's the engine's horsepower.
And that horsepower comes from this incredibly precise molecular process, right? Excitation-contraction coupling. You called it a calcium choreography earlier.
It really is a dance. And understanding the steps helps us understand how our drugs work, both the depressants and the inotropes.
Okay, walk us through that dance. Starts with the electrical signal.
Right. The action potential sweeps across the cardiomyocyte membrane. This opens voltage-gated calcium channels, specifically the L-type calcium channels. A little bit of calcium flows in from outside the cell.
It's just a trickle.
A small amount, but it's the critical trigger, the spark. This initial calcium influx then binds to receptors on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the SR, which is the cell's internal calcium store.
Those are the ryanodine receptors, RYR2.
Exactly. Binding of trigger calcium opens these RYR2 channels, causing a massive, rapid release of calcium from the SR into the cytoplasm. This is calcium-induced calcium release. It's an amplification step.
So small spark triggers a huge calcium flood. What does that calcium do?
That flood of calcium then finds and binds to troponin C, which is part of the thin filament complex. Binding causes troponin C to change shape, which pulls another protein, tropomyosin, out of the way.
Unblocking the binding sites.
Precisely. Unblocking the sites on actin, where the myosin heads can now attach. This allows the actin and myosin filaments to form cross bridges, cycle, and pull generating force. That's the contraction.
The squeeze. Okay, but the heart has to relax too, right? For filling. Diastole, how does it turn off?
Relaxation is an active, energy-consuming process. That calcium has to be removed from the cytoplasm very quickly.
Where does it go?
Most of it is pumped back into the SR by the Circa pumps, the sarcoendoplasmic reticulum ATPase. These pumps use a ton of ATP. A smaller amount of calcium is pumped back out of the cell.
So relaxation needs energy. That's important, especially if the heart is ischemic.
Absolutely. If ATP levels are low, Circa function slows down, calcium lingers in the cytoplasm, relaxation is impaired, diastolic dysfunction, and the next contraction starts from a compromised state.
Okay, now layer our anesthetics onto this calcium dance. How do they interfere?
Well, the volatile agents in propofol tend to be depressants. They can inhibit the L-type calcium channels, reducing that initial trigger calcium. They can also directly inhibit the RYR2 channels, blunting the calcium release from the SR. And some might even impair Circa function.
So less calcium release, maybe slower removal, weaker squeeze, potentially impaired relaxation. That's why we have to be cautious with dose, especially in patients with pre-existing heart problems.
Exactly. And this again highlights why etomidate is often favored in cardiac instability. It's largely neutral in this whole calcium cycling process. It doesn't significantly depress contractility.
And ketamine?
Ketamine, through its indirect sympathetic stimulation, actually tends to enhance contractility. The released norepinephrine hits beta-1 receptors, which boosts CAN-MP levels, leading to phosphorylation that enhances L-type channel function and Circa activity. So more calcium in, faster calcium out, stronger, quicker contraction and relaxation.
Okay, so what if the primary problem is contractility? The pump itself is weak. How do we target that pharmacologically?
That's when we reach for inotropes. Drugs like dopamine or epinephrine primarily work as agonists at the beta-1 adrenergic receptors on the heart muscle.
Which does what downstream?
Beta-1 activation increases intracellular cyclic AMP, CAMP. CAMP then activates protein kinases that phosphorylate key players in the calcium cycle, like the L-type channels, more calcium in, and phospholamban, which regulates Circa, faster calcium uptake into the SR.
So they effectively amplify the calcium signal and speed up the cycling.
Exactly. More forceful contraction, inotropy, and faster relaxation, lusitrope.
So the clinical clue that points you towards needing an inotrope, rather than just fluid or pressors.
It's when the filling pressures are adequate, or even high, you check a CVP or maybe even a PAOP, and they're up, but the cardiac output, the flow, is still low. The tank is full, maybe even overflowing, but the pump just isn't generating enough forward flow. That screams contractility failure.
And in that situation, giving more fluid is the wrong move?
Definitely harmful. You're just stretching an already failing ventricle, increasing wall stress, we'll get to Laplace's law, increasing oxygen demand, and pushing fluid back into the lungs. That patient needs pump support and inotrope.
Makes sense. Okay, final leg of the table. Leg number 4, heart rate.
Heart rate. The tempo of the pump, how many times does it beat per minute?
Fundamentally set by the pacemaker cells in the SA node, right? With that special funny current.
Yeah, if current drives that spontaneous depolarization.
Yeah.
But the actual rate is constantly being tweaked by the autonomic nervous system. Sympathetic nerves speed it up. The vagus nerve slows it down.
And there's a critical trade-off here with heart rate, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's a bit of a Goldilocks situation.
Yeah.
Too slow, bradycardia and CO drop simply because SVX, few beats per minute, equals low output. Not enough ejection events.
Okay, that's straightforward. But too fast. Tachycardia seems like it should increase output, but it's often bad news. Why?
Because of diastole. When the heart beats very rapidly, the time spent between beats, the diastolic filling time gets dramatically shorter.
And diastole is crucial for two things.
Exactly. One, That's when the ventricles fill with blood. If you shorten filling time too much, preload drops, stroke volume decreases, and CO can actually fall despite the fast rate.
And the second crucial thing happening in diastole.
Coronary perfusion. The heart muscle itself gets its blood supply almost exclusively during diastole, when the muscle is relaxed. If you drastically shorten diastole with extreme tachycardia, you starve the heart muscle of oxygen.
Which then impairs contractility, creating a vicious cycle.
Precisely. Tachycardia can lead to ischemia, which worsens function, potentially leading to more tachycardia. It can spiral downwards quickly.
And our anesthetic drugs play a big role here, too.
Oh, absolutely. Opioids, especially high doses, and dexmedetomidine are well known for increasing vagal tone and causing bradycardia.
And the volatiles, they don't usually cause bradycardia directly, but they do something else subtle.
They blunt the baroreflex. Normally, if blood pressure drops, the body triggers a reflex increase in heart rate to compensate. Volatile anesthetics dampen this reflex.
So the patient gets hypotensive from the vasodilation we talked about, but they can't mount that compensatory tachycardia. The heart rate just sits there, or might even drift down.
Exactly, which makes the hypotension worse.
So managing heart rate is also very context dependent.
Hugely. Take a patient with severe diastolic dysfunction, maybe hypertensive heart disease, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Their ventricle is stiff, doesn't relax well. They depend heavily on that passive filling during diastole.
So they need a slower rate?
Yes. They need time. Tachycardia is poison for them. It dramatically reduces their filling and their stroke volume.
Yeah.
You want to keep them slow and controlled, maybe 60, 70 BPM.
But on the flip side, think about that patient who just got a spinal anesthetic.
Right. Profound sympathectomy, often high vagal tone. They get hypotensive and bradycardic.
But their heart muscle itself might be perfectly healthy, good contractility, very preload responsive.
In that specific case, treating the bradycardia directly with an anticholinergic like atropine or glycopyrrolate can be incredibly effective. Just bumping the rate from, say, 40 up to 70 or 80 can sometimes double the cardiac output almost instantly, fixing the hypotension without needing massive fluid volumes.
So context is everything for heart rate management. Okay, we've got our four pillars: preload, afterload, contractility, heart rate. Now let's bridge this to the physics that govern it all.
All right, part three, the physics of flow. We've touched on some of this, but let's formalize it with three key laws: Ohm's law, Poiseuille's law, and Laplace's law. Think of these as the underlying grammar of hemodynamics.
Not just academic equations, but tools for bedside reasoning. They force a structure onto our thinking when things go wrong.
Let's start with the one we use implicitly all the time, Ohm's law. In electricity, voltage equals current times resistance, VIR.
How does that translate to the circulation?
Pressure is the driving force, like voltage. Flow is the movement of blood, like current. And resistance is the impedance from the vessels. So the hemodynamic version is pressure gradient equals flow times resistance.
Specifically, mean arterial pressure, MAP, minus central venous pressure, CVP. That's the pressure gradient across the systemic circulation.
It equals cardiac output, CO, the flow, times systemic vascular resistance, SVR. So MAP, CVP, COX, SVR.
Okay. Why is explicitly thinking about this equation so helpful?
Because if your MAP drops, which is usually what gets our attention, this equation forces you to ask, why did it drop? Did the flow CO decrease? Or did the resistance SVR decrease?
It prevents blind treatment. You can't just treat the low MAP number without knowing the cause.
Exactly. If SVR dropped, like with sepsis or deep anesthesia, giving fluids might not help much. You need a pressor. If CO dropped, like with hemorrhage or pump failure, giving a pure vasoconstrictor might actually hurt. You need to know which variable changed.
Which requires monitoring that gives you some idea of flow, CO, and resistance, SVR, not just pressure.
Precisely. Ohm's law provides the framework for interpreting that monitor data.
Okay, second law, Poiseuille's law. We hammered the radius to the fourth power relationship earlier, flow radius. So let's just cement its clinical implication.
It's all about the incredible sensitivity of flow to tiny changes in vessel diameter, especially in those resistance arterioles. It underscores the power and potential danger of our vasoactive drugs.
A small dose adjustment can have a massive impact on regional blood flow and overall resistance.
Right. And it highlights why just clamping down hard with a pure alpha agonist like phenylephrine might raise the MAP, but could potentially overconstrict the microcirculation, impairing tissue oxygen extraction, even if the macro numbers look better. There's a delicate balance.
You mentioned using a clamp like phenylephrine could be dangerous if CO is already low. Connect that back to Poiseuille and Ohm's.
Okay, so if CO is low because the heart muscle is weak, low contractility, and you then dramatically increase SVR using phenylephrine because resistance is inversely proportional to radius. So small radius decrease means huge SVR increase.
You're massively increasing the afterload, the resistance term in Ohm's law.
Exactly. You're asking a weak pump to push against a suddenly much higher resistance. The ventricle might not be able to generate enough pressure to overcome that load. Stroke volume could fall even further, making the CO worse, increasing myocardial oxygen demand, and potentially worsening ischemia. It's counterproductive.
Got it. Okay, third law, Laplace's law. This one relates to wall stress or tension.
Yes. The law of Laplace, for a sphere or cylinder like the ventricle, states that wall tension is proportional to pressure inside times the radius, divided by the wall thickness. Tension, PXR, thickness.
So what does that tell us practically?
Look at the radius term in the numerator. A larger ventricle, a dilated heart with a large radius, will experience significantly higher wall tension or stress, even at the same internal pressure.
And higher wall tension means?
Higher myocardial oxygen consumption, MVO. The muscle has to work harder just to contain that larger volume and generate pressure. This explains why dilated cardiomyopathies are so inefficient. They're big floppy bags that require a ton of oxygen just to maintain their structure, let alone pump effectively.
And this ties back directly to our discussion about contractility failure and fluid management.
Absolutely. If you have a patient with a dilated failing ventricle, high radius, and you give them a large fluid bolus,
you increase the radius even more,
which, according to Laplace, directly increases wall tension, spikes MVO rows, potentially worsens ischemia, and pushes them further into heart failure. It confirms why you don't want to overload a failing dilated heart. You need inotropes, not just volume.
So these three laws, Poiseuille, Laplace, they're really the underlying physics that explain why our four pillars, preload, afterload, contractility, rate, behave the way they do.
Exactly. They bridge the physiology to the bedside observations. Now, how do we actually see these things? That brings us to monitoring, part four, monitoring and the clinical algorithm.
Because we can't directly see the sarcomere stretch or the wall tension, we need tools to translate the invisible into something actionable.
And the tools have evolved. Historically, the gold standard for complex cases, especially cardiac surgery, was the pulmonary artery catheter, the PAC, or Swan-Ganz.
Right, using thermodilution to measure CO and giving us pressures like CVP and the wedge pressure, PAOP.
Let's just quickly recap those pressures. CVP, central venous pressure, reflects right atrial pressure, giving us an idea about right heart filling or volume status relative to RV function.
And PAOP, the pulmonary artery occlusion pressure or wedge pressure, is measured by inflating the balloon in a pulmonary artery branch. It estimates left atrial pressure,
which under normal conditions reflects left ventricular end diastolic pressure, LVEDP, our best invasive estimate of preload for the left ventricle.
The PAKE PIA gives a lot of data, but it's invasive, carries risks. So we've moved towards less invasive methods too.
Yeah, like the pulse contour analysis systems. Things like FlowTrack, LIDI-SAO, PC. These use the shape and variability of the arterial pressure waveform itself to estimate stroke volume beat by beat and then calculate CO continuously.
Much less invasive, just needs an arterial line usually. But they have limitations too, right?
They do. Their algorithms rely on assumptions about the relationship between pressure changes and flow changes in the aorta. If the patient's vascular tone changes dramatically, like in severe sepsis or profound vasodilation, we call vasoplegia, those assumptions can break down.
So the numbers might become unreliable just when you need them most.
Potentially, yeah. You have to interpret them cautiously in those extreme states.
But maybe the biggest shift in how we use monitors isn't just what we measure, but how we interpret it. Moving away from just static numbers like CVP and PAOP.
Towards dynamic indices of fluid responsiveness. This has been a huge conceptual leap.
Explain the principle behind these dynamic indices.
Okay, they leverage the interaction between positive pressure ventilation and the patient's circulation. When the ventilator pushes air in, it increases intrathoracic pressure, which momentarily decreases venous return and thus preload.
Right, we discussed that earlier.
If the patient is operating on the steep, ascending part of their Frank-Starling curve, meaning they are preload dependent, this cyclical change in preload caused by the ventilator will lead to a measurable cyclical variation in their stroke volume and pulse pressure.
So the ventilator breath acts like a mini fluid challenge, or rather a mini preload reduction test every single cycle.
Essentially, yes. And if the stroke volume or pulse pressure swings significantly with each breath, it tells you the patient is sensitive to changes in preload.
And the key indices we look at are
pulse pressure variation, PPV, and stroke volume variation, SVV. If the variation is large, typically a PPV greater than about 13%, or an SVV greater than 10-15%.
It strongly suggests the patient is fluid responsive, meaning giving them a fluid bolus is likely to significantly increase their stroke volume and cardiac output.
These dynamic indices have consistently been shown to be much better predictors of fluid responsiveness than static pressures like CVP or PAOP alone.
Huge advance. But there are caveats, right? They don't work for everyone.
Correct. Critical caveats. They really only work reliably in patients who are fully mechanically ventilated with a consistent tidal volume, usually 6 to 8 millidegal gyres, who are in a regular sinus rhythm, and whose chest is closed.
So spontaneous breathing efforts, arrhythmias like atrial fibrillation, open chest surgery, low tidal volumes, all these things mess up the interpretation.
Completely. They invalidate the underlying principle. So powerful tool, but you have to know when not to use it or how to interpret it cautiously if the conditions aren't perfect.
Okay, so we have the physiology, the physics, the monitoring tools. How do we put it all together when the alarm sounds, the pressure drops, and things are critical? We need a plan, an algorithm.
Yes, a structured clinical algorithm is key to avoiding panic and ensuring systematic targeted therapy. 4 basic steps.
Step 1, check the machine. Seems obvious, but easily missed in a crisis.
Absolutely. Is the arterial line waveform damped? Is it reading accurately? Is the transducer at the right level? Is there an air bubble? Rule out simple equipment malfunction first.
Makes sense. Don't treat an artifact. Step 2. Rule out disasters, the immediate life threats.
Right. Is there sudden massive hemorrhage? Could this be cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, acute pulmonary embolism, anaphylaxis? These are the can't-miss, fix-it-now diagnoses that require specific, often procedural interventions immediately.
Okay, ruled those out. Step 3, check the 4 pillars. Now we diagnose using our framework.
Exactly. Look at your monitors. What's the heart rate doing? What are the filling pressures, CVP, PAOP, or dynamic indices, PPV, SVV, telling you about preload? What's the estimated SVR telling you about afterload? And putting it all together, what's the likely state of contractility? Is the COSV low despite adequate filling?
You're basically diagnosing which leg of the table is broken.
Precisely. Then, step 4, act 1.
Precisely.
Targeted therapy based on your diagnosis.
Give us some examples.
Okay. If you diagnose primarily low preload, maybe post-trauma, or high PPV-SVV, the answer is usually volume resuscitation, maybe combined with a vasopressor if there's also vasodilation, to restore venous tone.
What if it's mainly low afterload vasoplegia, like in sepsis or deep anesthesia, warm patient, low SVR, maybe CO is okay initially?
Then the primary need is vasoconstriction. Start norepinephrine or maybe add vasopressin. Fluids might be needed too, but they won't fix the resistance problem alone.
And if it's contractility failure, high filling pressures, low COSV.
That's the indication for an inotrope. Dobutamine, epinephrine, maybe milrinone, depending on the context. You need to boost the pump's intrinsic strength. Avoid large fluid boluses here.
And finally, if it's clearly a rate problem, bradycardia or extreme tachycardia?
Treat the rhythm. Atropine or pacing for symptomatic bradycardia. Rate control or cardioversion for unstable tachycardia. Fix the tempo.
And the crucial final part of this algorithm is?
Iteration. Anesthesia isn't fire and forget. You make an intervention based on step 4, then you immediately reassess. Watch the monitors, check the trends, maybe repeat a lactate or look at urine output. Did it work? Do you need more? Do you need something different? It's a continuous loop.
A constant experiment, really, trying to find and maintain that hemodynamic equilibrium.
Absolutely. And that equilibrium point, the rules of flow, aren't the same for every patient. Which brings us to part 5, contextual flow and choosing drugs by mechanism. We have to consider special populations.
Good point. Let's start with the elderly. What are the key considerations there?
Older patients often have stiff ventricles due to age-related changes, diastolic dysfunction. They don't relax well. This means they are very dependent on adequate filling time and atrial contraction for their preload.
So what does that mean for management?
It means they need careful preload maintenance, avoid making them hypovolemic, but more importantly, they absolutely cannot tolerate tachycardia. A fast heart rate decimates their diastolic filling time and stroke volume.
Okay.
Aim for slow and full, maybe not truly full, but euvolemic and a controlled rate.
Okay. What about the sepsis patient? Very different physiology.
Totally different. Sepsis is the classic vasodilatory shock. The primary problem is profound loss of vascular tone, very low SVR. Cardiac output might actually be high initially as the heart tries to compensate, but the perfusion pressure is low because the pipes are wide open.
So the priority there is?
Early and aggressive vasopressor support. Norepinephrine is usually first line. You need to restore that resistance quickly, often even before you finish fluid resuscitation. Managing the vasoplegia is key.
All right. Another critical group, patients with severe aortic stenosis. What's the mantra there?
Maintain afterload. Maintain sinus rhythm. SOS creates a fixed obstruction to outflow. The left ventricle is usually hypertrophied and working incredibly hard to generate high pressure to get blood across that stenotic valve.
So they need high pressure after the valve to perfuse the rest of the body, and also high pressure before the valve to perfuse the thick heart muscle itself via the coronaries.
Exactly. If you let their systemic vascular resistance afterload drop significantly, their perfusion pressure plummets, potentially causing coronary ischemia and a sudden cardiovascular collapse. Avoid spinal epidural anesthesia if possible. Use vasopressors liberally to maintain MAP and treat any arrhythmias aggressively, especially atrial fibrillation, which kills their atrial kick contribution to preload. Tachycardia is also poorly tolerated.
Very tight margins. What about children, especially infants?
In infants and young children, the heart muscle is less compliant than in adults, and their stroke volume is relatively fixed. They can't easily increase their SV to compensate for problems.
So their cardiac output is almost entirely dependent on
heart rate. CO equals SVX HR. And if SV is fixed, CO tracks HR directly. This means bradycardia in an infant or small child is an immediate emergency. It directly translates to low cardiac output and requires urgent treatment, much more so than in adults.
Good distinction. Right. And finally, patients with known cardiomyopathy, meaning chronic systolic heart failure.
These patients live on the flat part of their Frank-Starling curve. Their ventricles are often dilated, poorly contractile, and have very little preload reserve.
So they have low tolerance for extra volume.
Extremely low tolerance. Mm-hmm. Even a modest fluid bolus can easily tip them over into pulmonary edema because the failing ventricle simply can't handle the increased volume.
So the therapeutic strategy shifts.
Yes. You generally want to favor inotropes to improve contractility rather than large fluid volumes. And you might need vasodilators carefully titrated to reduce afterload if SVR is high, but you have to support the pressure. It's often about optimizing loading conditions and supporting the pump, not just filling the tank.
This really highlights why we need to choose our drugs based on their specific mechanism of action. It's not just about picking a pressor or an inotrope.
Absolutely. Every drug we give sends a specific chemical message to the cardiovascular system. We need to know what that message is.
Let's compare the common ones. Norepinephrine, levofid. Why is it often first line?
Because it provides a good balance. It hits alpha-1 receptor strongly, causing vasoconstriction and increasing SVR, addressing low afterload. But it also has significant beta-1 receptor activity, which supports heart rate and contractility, inotropy. So it gives you both resistance and pump support. Great for most mixed or vasodilatory shock states like sepsis.
How does that compare to phenylephrine, neosinephrine?
Phenylephrine is a pure alpha-1 agonist. It's a pure clamp. All it does is vasoconstrict, increasing SVR. It has essentially no direct effect on the heart muscle itself. No beta activity.
So when is that useful and when might it be bad?
It can be useful when the only problem is vasodilation or venous pooling and you're confident the heart function, contractility, is good. Like maybe transient hypotension after spinal anesthesia. But as we discussed, if the heart is already struggling, clamping down hard on the afterload with phenylephrine can decrease stroke volume and CO. It can increase the work of the heart without improving flow. So use it cautiously if you suspect any cardiac dysfunction.
What about vasopressin? Different mechanism entirely.
Yeah, vasopressin acts on V1 receptors in vascular smooth muscle. It causes vasoconstriction completely separate from the adrenergic system. This makes it really valuable in shock states that are refractory to catecholamines, like norepinephrine or epinephrine, or sometimes as an adjunct in septic shock to reduce the total catecholamine dose needed. It also tends to cause less pulmonary vasoconstriction than high-dose catecholamines might.
Okay, shifting to pump support. Dobutamine, what's its profile?
Dobutamine is primarily a beta-1 agonist, so its main effect is increasing contractility and inotropy. It also has some beta-2 activity, which can cause peripheral vasodilation, actually lowering SVR slightly.
So it strengthens the squeeze but might lower the resistance.
Correct. This makes it great for situations where the primary problem is systolic heart failure, weak pump, and you want to improve CO without significantly increasing afterload, or maybe even decrease it slightly. Classic cardiogenic shock drug.
And then there are the phosphodiesterase inhibitors like milrinone. How do they fit in?
Milrinone works differently. It inhibits the enzyme, PDE3, that breaks down cyclic AMP inside cardiac and smooth muscle cells. By preventing KMP breakdown, it effectively increases KMP levels.
Similar net effect to beta agonists, then.
In the heart, yes, increased KMP enhances calcium handling, leading to increased contractility, inotropy, and faster relaxation, lusitropy. But importantly, in the smooth muscle, increased KMP causes relaxation.
Ah, so it's an enodilator.
Exactly. It boosts pump function and causes both systemic and pulmonary vasodilation, afterload reduction. This could be very useful in acute decompensated heart failure, especially right heart failure with pulmonary hypertension, where you want both inotropic support and pulmonary vasodilation. But because of vasodilates, you have to be careful about blood pressure.
This level of mechanistic understanding really is crucial for tailoring therapy, isn't it? It's not just grabbing the nearest syringe.
Not if you want to be precise and effective. It's about diagnosing the specific physiological failure and choosing the tool that addresses that mechanism.
Okay, let's try to wrap this up with a couple of simple takeaways or mnemonics.
For diagnosis, the four pillars. PACH. Always think. Preload, afterload, contractility, heart rate. Which one or more is the problem?
PACH. Got it. And maybe that circuit analogy.
Yeah, if it helps. Think of the circulation like an electrical circuit. Pressure, MAP, is the voltage source. Flow, CO, is the current. Resistance, SVR, is the resistance in the wires. And the vital organs, the cells, are the light bulbs that need the current flow to stay lit.
And our job is to be the engineer, constantly adjusting the voltage, resistance, and maybe the power source itself, contractility, to make sure those bulbs stay brightly lit with oxygen.
That's a pretty good way to visualize it.
So to summarize this whole deep dive, cardiac output isn't just COSVXHR. It's this living, dynamic conversation happening constantly between volume, resistance, muscle strength, and timing.
And real skill in anesthesia and critical care comes from moving beyond just reacting to numbers and truly interpreting that physiological conversation in motion, understanding the why behind the numbers.
So the next time you see that pressure drop, pause for a second. Don't just reach reflexively. Think PACH. Think Ohm's law. Is it flow? Is it resistance? Is it the pump? Is it the rate? Choose your therapy based on that diagnosis, on the underlying mechanism.
Because if you truly understand the flow, you gain mastery over the patient's stability.
Anesthesia is not the suppression of awareness. It's the mastery of flow. Powerful thought to end on. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.